Our reading this evening is Proverbs chapter 31. You'll find it on page 665. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty, and remember their misery no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. An excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates.
Thank you, Jeremy. So please do keep that open, and you'll see that this week, because we had all the song words on the screen, that means you've got double the space for taking notes or doodling, whatever you want to do. So if you want a pen, Stuart, I'm sure, will come round with a pen now. So you can pretty much take this down word for word, I think, with a double spread if you want to, into shorthand. So we're picking up again this series on looking at work, biblical perspective on work. We've had four earlier on. If you didn't hear those four, do go on the website and listen to those, because they all sort of slot together as a bit of a jigsaw, and any one on their own might give you a bit of a distorted picture. But we're looking at wisdom at work today. And just want to say as well, before we launch in, a very, very big welcome to Sitla and Gigi, so our mission partners who are over from South Africa, from Soweto. Wonderful to have Sitla back with us. Sitla was here for 2 years. 4 years ago he left. Can you believe it's 4 years ago that Sitla left? And has now come back with a wife. So Gigi, so we've heard lots about her, lots of email contact, but nice to actually meet her as well. So we're going to be hearing a bit from them at the end of the service. But a special welcome to them. Okay, wisdom at work. In India today, there are apparently 4 to 5 million sadhus, I think is how you pronounce it, They live in caves, they live in forests, they live in temples. And these sadhus are the ultra-committed holy men of Hinduism. So they are ascetics who have withdrawn from the business of ordinary life to devote themselves to a life of meditation. And so through yoga and meditation and contemplation of God, they hope to achieve liberation from this cycle of reincarnation. In secular philosophy, this same ideal of the life of contemplation goes back at least as far as the Greek philosopher Plato in the 4th century BC. So in his book, The Republic, which I'm sure is your bedtime reading, Plato argued that the best life of all is the life of philosophy and rational thinking and reasoning, a life of contemplation and leisure. Sounds impressive. But in the book of Proverbs, God makes pretty clear that that is barking up the wrong tree. Yeah, the good life looks very, very different to that. It's not a life of withdrawal and contemplation. It is a life of engagement and action. A life of practical godliness, in which we walk on the path of wisdom in the ordinary activities of everyday life, and especially in our work, which, let's face it, takes up so much of our waking lives. And this practical nature of true wisdom is there on pretty much every page in the book of Proverbs, but it is epitomized in this final chapter and in these two characters that we meet. So a man and a woman, a king and a housewife. So two examples, one negative, one positive, two very, very different life situations, but the same emphasis, which is on practical godliness in working life. Or I guess we could borrow the title of J.C. Ryle's book, Practical Religion. That's what we're talking about. So firstly, in verses 1 to 9, the foolish man at work. This is the negative. So verse 1 begins, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? What a legacy. All we know about this foreign king Lemuel is what we have here in these 9 verses. And it's just a stinging rebuke. So he may have been king, but they didn't stop his mam giving him a right wigging. What are you playing at? She's saying to him 3 times in verse 2. He gets a right royal telling off by his mum. Why? Well, because at work he was being a fool. And in particular in 3 areas. So firstly, he had a problem with sex. Verse 3, do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. Now, this isn't saying that, you know, women are evil and destructive and we should keep well clear of them. Chapter 18, verse 22, in fact, says that he who finds a wife finds a good thing and he obtains favour from the Lord. But on King Lem's radar, there wasn't a wife, but women. It seems he was a womanizer. He was someone who used his power, his position, to get what he wanted, to satisfy his sexual passions. And his sexual immorality was sapping his moral strength, and it would be his downfall unless he did something about it pretty rapidly. And so a good question for us to ask ourselves would be, how is it with us in this area? Are we fooling around in this area of working life? We need to be aware of the dangers of flirting and lusting in the workplace, the dangers of the workplace affair. How do you relate to colleagues of the opposite sex at work? We need to be aware of pornography as an escape from the pressures of work. If we're wise, we'll pursue purity in this area in thought and in action. Secondly, though, he had a problem with drink. So verse 4 goes on, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink. So as king, he would have had access to as much alcohol as he wanted, and it seems he was making the most of it. Yeah, he had an alcohol problem. Why was that serious? Well, because it affected his judgment. So it says it's not for kings, verse 5, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. So people who came to him were being denied justice. He wasn't doing his job rightly because he was drinking, and that was clouding his judgment. And that, of course, is one of the problems of drink, isn't it? That under its influence, we do what is wrong and we neglect what is right. So in verses 6 to 7, he's told that the poor in his land are in such misery because of his bad rule that they could well do with all his drink to drown their sorrows. And so again, it's good to ask ourselves, are we fooling around in this area of working life? We need to beware the dangers of drink, of maybe using drink as a way of coping with stress, of having too much on the night out with colleagues. If we're wise, we'll be sober, we'll be self-controlled, we'll be those who are filled with the Spirit, not filled with drink. One woman was telling me how just this last week her team from work went out for a night out. And she made a point of leaving. She's a Christian. She made a point of leaving just as all the drinking games were getting underway. Next morning when she went into work, they were all laughing about it and how they'd got completely legless. And, you know, one guy had to pay 120 quid to get a taxi home because he was so comatose. And they thought it was such a laugh. And, of course, she was made to feel on the outside because she'd left. Wisdom can be a lonely business. Wisdom can be a lonely business. But thirdly, notice he was misusing his power. Verse 8, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Instead of opening his mouth to pour in more wine, he should have been opening his mouth to speak up for the rights of the poor and the oppressed. But he wasn't doing that. And again, it's worth us just reflecting on, are we fooling around in this area of work? Beware abusing power. Position, power in the workplace, they're given us not so we can feed our ego, not so we can prove ourselves, not so we can control, manipulate other people for our own ends. If we're wise, we'll see position, we'll see power and influence. See it as a gift from God so that we can do good. We can better help people. We can serve other people. If you were here for the first in this series, we saw in Genesis 1 and 2 that we were created to rule the world under God, and we saw that work was one way that we are to express that rule. But working life, we learn here, brings with it temptations. Did for King Lemuel, it does for us today. And the warning to King Lemuel, it applies to all of us in our work, but is particularly applicable to those who, like him, work in positions of leadership and responsibility. So whether it's in the work of your job or the work of the home or here at church, the misuse of these three things, sex, drink, power, three big temptations in working life. Now we're aware, aren't we, that the papers all too often carry stories of the downfall of yet another leader, often because of compromise in one of these areas. But if King Lemuel's mum, if she knew what was going on in your life at the moment, in these areas of sex, drink, power, would she take you on one side and would she give you a right wigging and say, what are you doing? What are you playing at? How do you behave at work? In the staff room, on the business trip, on the work night out, alone behind closed doors. We need to be wise at work. And if we are being fools at work, we need to repent of that. And we need to come back to the cross. We need to rejoice in God's forgiveness and cleansing. We need to ask him for renewed hearts, which want to be wise. And if any of these three, sex, drink, power, if they've become an obsession, an addiction, we mustn't just ignore that. We mustn't just hope it's going to go away. Do seek help. Do tell a friend if need be. Do get some expert help. This right rule telling off is actually, it's quite a sad statement, isn't it, at the end of Proverbs. Yet another ruler who messes up. And remember, this is King Solomon's book. But of course, he was no better. You know, in the end, sex was King Solomon's downfall. And it's easy, isn't it, to get disillusioned with those in leadership, to get disillusioned with life in the workplace, to get disillusioned, let's face it, with sin in our own lives. But in Isaiah 11, there is this prophecy of a coming king who is everything that King Lemuel wasn't and everything that we aren't. And we read in Isaiah 11 that he would have the spirit of wisdom and understanding, that his delight would be in the fear of the Lord, and that with righteousness he would judge the poor. And as we know, this perfect king has now come. He's died for us, for all our sins. He's been raised to life, and he's enthroned. And soon he'll return. And soon we will be enjoying life in his new world under his perfect rule forever. But in the meantime, he gives us, as his people, gives us forgiveness. He gives us his spirit so that we can be like him. And so it's in him that we find the power we need to live wisely at work. Power to change is found in the gospel. So in what Jesus has done for us and in what Jesus is doing in us by his spirit. But this king, flawed King Lemuel, he doesn't have the last word in Proverbs, because in the rest of the chapter, we're presented with perfection. And that is this woman of verses 10 to 31, who is the very embodiment of wisdom. So you'll see from the footnote at the bottom of the page, footnote 6, that these verses, verses 10 to 31, are an acrostic poem. And what that means is that each verse begins with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And the idea is it makes the poem more memorable in Hebrew. So, completely useless for us, but there we go. It also conveys the idea that this woman covers all the bases. You know, so just as an A to Z of London contains every street, so this woman, she is an A to Z of wise living in practice. She covers all the bases. So verses 10 to 12 introduce us to the woman. Verses 13 through to 27 catalogue all her deeds. And then it rounds off in 28 to 31 with this invitation to join in praise of her. So what did wise living look like in this woman's working life? Well, basically what we have here is a description of tireless activity on behalf of her household. So just to run through it with you, her work involved the following things. Purchasing, so buying provisions for her household, verse 13, says that she seeks wool and flax and describes as being like a merchant ship sailing off, coming back laden with provisions from Waitrose. Bit of product placement there, thank you, Alison. Her work involved production. So verse 15, she's providing food for her household. Verse 19, she's at the spinning wheel making things. Verse 22, even makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Verse 27 says she looks well to the ways of her household, doesn't eat the bread of idleness. So purchasing, production, selling. Verse 24, she makes linen garments and sells them. Delivers sashes to the merchants. Her work, we learn here, involved long hours. She labored night and day, verse 15. She rises while it's yet night. Verse 18, her lamp does not go out at night. And notice that her work involves not just providing for her own household, but also for the poor and needy. Verse 20, she opens her hands to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. Her work also involved being wise in what she says and teaching her children. Verse 26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. And if we ask the question, what was the root of all this, this activity? What was the source of it? Verse 30 tells us, a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So all these labours were the practical outworking of her fear of the Lord. Now, what can we learn from this? Will wise living, will it look exactly the same for women today as it did for this woman back then? So is the home the only legitimate sphere for godly women to work in? What does this have to say to men? Well, I put on your sheet there, the outline, 3 points that I think we can draw from this. And the first one is, be a wise worker. Be a wise worker. wisdom wears working clothes. This woman's life situation was very, very different to King Lemuel's, but the message is the same. What God requires of us as his people is that we fear him, and that we live out this fear of the Lord in the practical, ordinary business of daily life, daily working life. And so the ultimate is not, as we're thinking at the beginning, it's not to withdraw into this life of contemplation, but the ultimate is to get on with being a woman or a man of God in your work. And for the king, that meant sorting out his problems at work with sex and drink and power and starting to rule with integrity. And for this woman, it meant running her household with hard work and dedication to provide for the needs of her husband and children and the poor around her. What will it mean for you? What will it mean for you? Notice that the wise life to which God calls us is very much a hands-on affair. The poem is in two halves, corresponding to the two halves of the Hebrew alphabet. The first half ends with verses 19 and 20. And just look out for the hands in verses 19 and 20. Verse 19, she puts her hands to the distaff. Her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hands to the poor. She reaches out her hands to the needy. Her wise living is a hands-on affair. And that is something the book of Proverbs is really keen to impress upon us. That the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom, is to be expressed in a very hands-on way in daily life. So wisdom gets its hands dirty in practical godliness. Wisdom is seen at work. We went through, didn't we, the letter of James last year, which is also wisdom literature, and we find exactly the same emphasis there, namely that faith, if it is genuine, will be seen in action, and in very practical, down-to-earth action at that. J.C. Ryle said, "It is not the man who hides himself in a cave," so remember what we're thinking about at the beginning, "not the man who hides himself in a cave, but the man who glorifies God as master or servant, parent or child, in the family, in the street, in business and in trade, who is the scriptural type of the sanctified man." We could add, or woman. And so working life does not take us away from serving the Lord. It is part of our serving the Lord. It's a key way that we live out this wise life. Now, I don't know, but do you ever feel that God is only interested in the 15 minutes a day that you spend having a quiet time, if you do that, praying and reading the Bible? And you maybe feel guilty that you can't spend more time doing that because you've got, you know, 10 hours to go to work or whatever. Well, this woman in this chapter shows how wrong that sort of thinking is. She's the ideal. The life fully pleasing to God is refreshingly ordinary and every day. So God delights in our service of him in the 95% of our day as renewed by our quiet time. So quiet time's a good thing, but renewed by that, we're supposed to go out in our daily life and work in the fear of the Lord and work hard for him. Now, by contrast with this wise worker, Proverbs has a good deal to say about the fool. And one of the marks of the fool in Proverbs is laziness. Chapter 6, verse 6 famously says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. How long will you lie there, O sluggard?" And when you read through Proverbs, the sluggard, he won't begin things. He won't finish things. He won't face things. Comes up with the most ridiculous excuses for inaction. For example, in 26:13, the sluggard says, "There's a lion in the road." I mean, what a crazy reason for just sitting down and doing nothing. There's a lion outside. The fool in Proverbs is lazy. And before we dismiss that and say, well, you know, that's not my problem, I think it's just worth being aware that sometimes we can be diligent in some aspects of working life, but lazy in others. And so, just to pick on men for a moment, you know, a Christian man may work really hard in his job, but then maybe bone idle in other areas of working life. The work of finding a wife For example, you know, taking the initiative, being proactive in that work. Or the work of the home, in cultivating his marriage, caring for his wife, leading his family. The work of serving the Lord, in serving other believers, taking responsibility in the local church, being committed to the spread of the gospel. The work of cultivating his own spiritual life and growth in godliness. We need to work hard across the board, not just in our jobs. So firstly, be the wise worker. Secondly, praise the wise worker. The wise woman at work here is a hero, or heroine. So verse 10 begins, an excellent wife who can find. Now that word excellent is not actually a great translation. So the word is translated elsewhere in the Bible as mighty or valiant. And it's used elsewhere in the Bible to describe male warriors in phrases such as a mighty man of valor or mighty men of war. Now you can understand, can't you, why the translators didn't go for mighty woman as a description. It doesn't quite feel right. Maybe conjures up images of a female shot putter in the former German Democratic Republic. A mighty woman. But the imagery in this poem is heroic. I've nothing against shot putters, by the way. The word translated gain in verse 11, for example, that is the word used elsewhere for spoil from a battle. Yeah, so it's military language. And this picture of a warrior is reinforced by references to her strength. So verse 17, verse 25 talks about her strength. She occupies a position of dignity. Verse 25 says that strength and dignity are her clothing. So you see the point here that this industrious woman running her household is heroic. She's strong, she's active, she's dignified, she's capable. She is the female equivalent of the Old Testament male warrior going out to battle, returning home, a conquering hero. That is the biblical perspective. And so this tells us that the Christian person seeking to live out their faith in the everyday of the workplace, in God's sight, is a hero. It's one thing we can take from this. It may not seem impressive, but if that's you, you are in God's book of heroes. Now, I think one of the problems with church history is that the heroes who are held up to us tend to be those in full-time gospel work. You know, so they're church ministers, theologians, missionaries. And it gives the impression that those are God's heroes. But God's hero gallery isn't as restricted as that. Yeah, the God's hero gallery is full of lots and lots of ordinary men and women who are doing their daily work for the Lord, who are living out their faith in the mundane realities of everyday life and work. And I think we need more biographies of such workers. Yeah, instead of just biographies of the George Whitfields and the John Calvins, great though they were. So if you're a writer, there you go. There's an invitation for you. There aren't many. I mean, Andrew has mentioned one, Sir John Lang before, founder of the Lang construction business. He began his working life in Carlisle, where we were as a family before he came down to the barge. In fact, when I began in a church up in Carlisle, someone gave me the biography of this guy, John Lang, because he was a local hero. Basically, he became a captain of industry. He lived out his faith in the workplace, very distinctive, made a fortune, gave it all away to good causes, to the gospel. He was known at work as somebody who, quote, radiated the immense impression of peaceful happiness, simplicity, and contentment. We need more biographies, don't we, of such everyday Christian heroes. So that's, I think, a general point we can draw from this. A more specific point we can draw from this, though, is that the godly Christian housewife is heroic in God's sight. Now, by housewife, I mean the dictionary definition of housewife, which is a woman managing a household. So if in your mind at the moment you have the stereotype of the 1950s woman of leisure and luxury, who hardly gets her hands dirty, and who just has very little to do apart from her nails and sort of drinking tea with the ladies. Put that out of your mind. That's not certainly not what Proverbs 31 is thinking about. For this woman, running a household meant hard graft day and night to provide for the material, the emotional, the spiritual needs of her family. Such a godly housewife is heroic in God's sight. Now, it's worth just pausing that for a moment, because that is very, very different, isn't it, to how many people in our society view working in the home. So in our society, many view the role of housewife as being, it's beneath women. Yeah, so to run a household, to provide for your husband, to raise children, is regarded as being, you know, it's demeaning. It's not making the most of your abilities. It's wasting your life and your talents when you could be climbing up the professional ladder. But in God's sight, we learn here that the godly, hard-working housewife is a heroine, is a champion. And if we look down on such a role, we are letting our minds be shaped more by the world than the word. And so, if you are a housewife, there's not many here in this service, I'm aware, but if you are a housewife, or if your wife is a housewife, that is something to be proud of, not something to be embarrassed about. A quote for you from Theodore Roosevelt, who wrote, "The good mother, the wise mother, is more important to the community than even the ablest man. Her career is more worthy of honour, is more useful to the community than the career of any man, no matter how successful." Don't know what you make of that quote by Roosevelt, maybe overstating it a little bit, but the Bible would certainly say as important, though our culture clearly doesn't. The title of one book sums up this dichotomy. The title is "The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued." And let's face it, many mothers are made to feel, I'm only a mother. Yeah, I'm only a mother. They're looked down on as someone who doesn't work. People ask disdainfully things like, what do they do all day? You know, what do they get up to all day? And, you know, people talk about the importance of family, and yet the work it takes to make a family can be utterly disregarded. And so as Christians of all people, we should be those who champion the importance of the work of the home, who hold it in high esteem, who support those who do it, and we should encourage mothers to give themselves to it. Now, obviously being a housewife is your job is not an option for all women. The single woman, the married woman without children, the married woman whose children have grown up and left home. So for some women, their circumstances will mean that they will need to go out to work because they don't have a family to raise or a household to run, or because it is a financial necessity, as it is for many in London. And so the context in which those women are to express practical godliness during the day, maybe the office, or the classroom, or the hospital ward, as well as doing their share of all the necessary household work when they get home. I think it's also worth flagging up that we need to acknowledge that running a household in modern Western culture is not maybe as demanding as it was in that ancient culture. Women today tend not to grow their own food, most of the ones I know, tend not to make all their clothes and their bed coverings by hand. So, you know, running a household in our culture, it may well be combined with what we would call work outside the home. But, you know, when all is said and done, we mustn't ignore the important place that running a household has in the Bible. A couple of references from the New Testament for you. 1 Timothy 5:14. Paul says, "I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households." Titus 2:4, older women are to train the younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, to be pure, working at home, kind and submissive to their own husbands. And so I think we just need to beware an attitude which dismisses the role of running a household as being petty, unrewarding, unfulfilling, unchallenging. Very, very striking, isn't it, that to end this book, a book about wise living, the model that God leaves us with to sum up everything is not, it's not a warrior, it's not a ruler, but it's a housewife. And so if you are a husband, are you doing what verse 28 says? Verse 28 says, her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. So if you're a husband, do you praise your wife for the way she is working out her fear of the Lord in practical godliness, in whatever working environment that is? And then specifically, if she is a housewife, do you praise her for the way she's working out practical godliness in that context? Or do you just take it for granted? Do you maybe make her feel she's not doing anything of any great importance? Are you even encouraging your wife to be a career woman because her success in the world's eyes would reflect well on you? Perish the thought. Final point, marry the wise worker. Proverbs is written in the first place as instruction to young men. So 18:22, I've quoted already. It encourages the finding of a wife with the words, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favour from the Lord." But this final poem in the book is urging us to make a wise choice. So it's saying, make sure biblical criteria govern your choice. And that principle applies equally to single women as it does to single men. What it's telling us is that practical godliness in daily life, in daily work, that matters more than things like physical beauty. So verse 30 sums it up and says, charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So in God's value system, fearing him and living wisely is of infinitely greater worth than things like charm and the fact that someone looks $1 million. And so the point is, do not be fooled by what someone looks like. Don't be fooled by how sexy or by how charming they are. That isn't what is most important, and it isn't going to last. But instead, we need to be asking the question, does this person fear the Lord? If not, forget it. You know, the relationship is biblically a non-starter. And secondly, are they working out their fear of the Lord in practical godliness? And if not, keep looking. It is very, very sad when you talk to someone who has realized too late that they didn't marry wisely, but they were fooled by superficial things. But as we close, a final thing we're supposed to take from this on the marriage point is this, that whether we're married or single, get married to Lady Wisdom. Get married to Lady Wisdom. So basically in chapter 9, we meet two women who aren't real women at all. They personify the basic choice we face in life. The choice between folly and wisdom. And at one level, this woman in Proverbs 31, she's not a real woman either. She is Lady Wisdom making a final appearance in the book. So for example, in verse 10 here it says, an excellent wife who can find, she is far more precious than jewels. You look back in chapter 3, exactly the same terms are used in chapter 3 about wisdom, Lady Wisdom. 3:13 says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom, she is more precious than jewels. So on one level, this excellent woman of Proverbs 31, she is a picture of wisdom. And this is a final invitation to embrace her in life and to get married to her. Now, this wisdom of God finds its fullest expression and embodiment in the Lord Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 1:24 describes Christ as the power of God and the wisdom of God. It says that God made Christ our wisdom. Colossians 2:3 says that he is the one in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so whether we're married or single, what matters ultimately is that we are united to Jesus, the wisdom of God. And that as those who are in him, that we are committed to walking the path of wisdom, fearing the Lord, A wisdom which is lived out in the nitty-gritty of everyday working life. A wisdom that serves God in our work as we were created to do.